This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
So here's the point of the program where I say welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour, and that part of the program we call the Big Picture, where Jim Poplava tries to elucidate on trends. We're awash in data points out there, either in news or in monetary news specifically. What does this all mean? What are the trends? Jim Poplava, John Loeffler here. So what we're going to do today, we've been talking about a whole series of different things on the show. Here we are, heading toward the end of October, and we need to do some summaries of things and show you how trends are moving together. And most of these are not being spotted either individually or then how they converge. Convergence would probably be the rule of thumb that we need to discuss here. This year has been a year of developing themes, and we see these in monetary policy and the markets. We're in the middle of a market euphoria. I mean, there was a film based on one of John Gresham's novel, Runaway Jury. This looks like a runaway market. And the real question is, how long can this run before it gets tackled? But right now it's running. And what does that mean? And so we'll take a look today on the Big Picture at a bunch of these themes. Anything you want to say at the opening, Jim, before we jump into each of the items?
No, I mean, other than the fact, as we have talked about in previous programs, in fact, last week we covered this, the melt up before the meltdown. And I think, John, we are beginning to see this melt up phase very much like we saw between 1998 and, let's say, the year 2000, when the NASDAQ was going up. In 99, the NASDAQ was up, 70% in the year 1999. And then we began the year 2000. It was up 20% in the first 3 months of the year before it peaked. And so, just like the runaway jury, we got a runaway market, which is very consistent in the final stages, in the final innings of a market upturn, where you see the melt up in the euphoria. And more importantly, you've got the individuals back into the market, which is something that has been absent up until after the election.
It always reminds me, by way of an analogy, a lot of times before an engine, especially aircraft prop engines, will flame out for lack of fuel. They actually go faster, you know, because the mixture leans out. They go just before they quit. And it reminds you of the same thing. All right, let's jump into the first trend here. President Trump's presidency is different. It's different for a series of different reasons. Never before in a presidency have the mainline media, the established media, thrown off any objectivity and dedicated themselves to his downfall. You and I have been in this business a long time, Jim. I never thought I would see it quite like this. But they're going to have a long time trying to recover their credibility, except for the true believers who continue to believe that they're getting news, straight news. But that's not the case.
I guess I experienced it in the 91 elections, John, when I was doing television news at that time. Insane to have a day job and then go down to the studio at night. But we were coming out of a recession in the summer of 91 during the election. And the lagging indicator in any kind of economic recovery is the employment rate. And of course, that was back when companies were laying off. IBM laid off, 20,000 employees. And so we were covering that. But one of the other stories I was covering is, hey, the LEIs and the economic indicators were turning up. And I felt we were coming out of a recession. Well, that's not what my producers wanted me to talk about on evening news. They wanted me to go with all the negative news, which was the layoffs. So the bulk of my presentation would be, well, IBM is laying off somebody. This company's laying off somebody. So we went with the layoffs. I would throw in some of the economic indicators that show that this thing's turning around. But the emphasis and the lead stories were always about layoffs. And then after the election, when Clinton won the election, then they switched and, hey, go ahead and talk about the positive economic stuff that was happening. So it made it look like when Clinton got elected that the economy, which was in a recovery, because the recovery began in the summer of 1991, that it was basically attributed to President Clinton, even though he hadn't assumed office yet. So that was my first exposure to what I call media bias, in addition to the type of interviews we would do, and then the way we would take sound bites. John, you're familiar with this. We'd take them out of context and build a story around them when that wasn't the real story.
which now, at least back then in the early 1990s, you still had the pretext on the part of the established groups that they were actually doing news reporting. And it was sort of hard to argue against that. You know, talk radio was just coming into its own as a counterbalance to that and offering a different view on the very same stories. But during this election campaign, they just threw it to the wind. I've never seen. And I don't know if you noticed this week or not. You remember, when we first went through the election period, then all we heard was Russia, 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 Russia. Okay. And every night we heard some leak from somebody's cousin in some intelligence department who heard something about whatever, which was probably a felony for him to leak anyway, but nobody cared and they would run with this rumor. And that's all we heard for week after week after week. And then all of a sudden it just went away. So this week, everybody's been bouncing back and forth between the Weinstein scandal and something that President Trump said to a widow of a soldier who had been killed, and that caught fire. What the real story was, FBI uncovered Russian bribery plot before Obama administration approved controversial nuclear deal with Moscow. Bribery, kickbacks, extortion money, and also payments into the Clinton Foundation. This was a big story, and it didn't come out from a radical newspaper. It came out from The Hill this week. You didn't find that, did you, on the mainline media? It's been buried, because what the Democrats had always been worried about is that this whole thing would blow back in their faces. And it's just about to do that. Now, the point of all of this being, the media are not being level-headed, equal standards as they apply to all of the political parties. And that's the point to be made here, regardless of which side you stand on. And that's why we have a new independent media structure here in this country, and why the war against free speech is now kicked up as much as it has. Because if you can't defeat them by reason, argument, keep them from speaking. So we have to get back to President Trump, though. He, like a couple of other presidents, have come in during an aging business cycle and a rate raising cycle. They all wound up being one-term presidents. So that's what President Trump is flying against. And we're also $20 trillion in debt. How much were we in debt at Reagan? Do you remember, Jim?
I think when Reagan left office, we were about $1 trillion. But the thing that really stands out, and we did this, John, I think in our first show of the year, the forecast issue, because after Trump got elected, if you're in the financial business, you get a new president from another party. He wins the presidency. Or in this case, it could have been a she. And what you do is you look at, okay, what did that candidate run on? Okay, what was Trump running on? Well, the border issue was one, but he ran on three main economic issues. One was the repeal of Obamacare. Number two was tax cuts. Number three was infrastructure spending. So those were the three things economically that Trump was proposing. And so as we began to look at that after he got elected, we were looking at, okay, how is this going to impact the economy? And the things that really struck me, I went back all the way to World War II, the end of World War II, and I looked at most presidents begin their first term of office in a recession. Go back to Ronald Reagan, the recession in 1981. Go back to, let's say, Bill Clinton. Well, actually not Bill Clinton, because the economy was recovering, as I alluded to earlier. George W. Bush comes in 2001, and we're in a recession. Obama comes in 2009. We're in a recession. What is also different and equal in those presidencies, in addition to being in a recession, the Federal Reserve was cutting interest rates. Under Obama, the Fed had already cut interest rates to zero, but it was in a rate-lowering mode. It initiated, in the first 2 months of office, quantitative easing. We got QE1, QE2, and QE3. So the Fed was lowering interest rates and money printing in the Obama administration. Under Bush, the Fed had cut the Fed funds rate. Under Greenspan, he had cut the Fed funds rate at 1% and kept them there for an extended period of time. And it wasn't until 2004 that the Fed began to raise interest rates. So you contrast that to the only other president that I could find that was similar to Trump was Bush Sr., because Bush Sr. took office at the end of the Reagan administration. He inherited a business cycle which was in its latter stages. In the last couple of years of George H. Bush's presidency, the Fed began to raise interest rates. And that eventually led to a recession, in 1991. Now, what we had in during that period of time as well was a spike in oil prices as a result of the Gulf War. Oil went from almost $20 a barrel to up to $40 a barrel. So you had an increase in inflation, which caused the Fed to raise interest rates as a result of inflation, oil prices. You had a short-term war and aging business cycle. The result was the recession came at the end of the Bush presidency rather than at the beginning, where if you look at Bush Jr., he came into office when we were in a recession. So presidents that come in and enter office their first year have typically entered their first year into office with a recession and the Fed lowering interest rates. That indeed is not the case with President Trump. In fact, he enters office with three things that no other president has had. Number one, $20 trillion in debt that is going to limit this president from doing anything he wants to do, from tax cuts to infrastructure to rebuilding the military. Number two, he's also entering office in the latter stages of a business cycle. And we know business cycles eventually come to an end because of reason number three. He enters office when the Fed is raising interest rates. And we know that every recession since World War II was triggered by a Fed rate raising cycle. Now, rates are so low from where they began. They began at zero and we're at 1.25, going up to 1.5 here probably in December. So we're beginning from a lower base, so the Fed still has room to grow, but it's not going to be able to raise interest rates like it has previously. If you look at the trends over the last three decades, the Fed funds rate has been coming down, lower highs and lower lows. So the trend has been lower, and it is unlikely this time that the Fed will be able to raise interest rates anywhere near where they've been in the past before they eventually break the economy, which is what they'll end up doing. So when we looked at the Trump presidency and we articulated this in our first program of the year, what was making it different in so many ways was the debt that he inherited, $20 trillion, aging business cycle, and a Fed rate raising cycle. And we're going to talk about how this is going to create problems for anything that the president wants to do in an additional theme that we are developing here. But nonetheless, Trump is different than other presidents because his presidency is beginning in a way no others have begun, other than, let's say, George Sr.
Let's move on to the next trend, because it is unusual in the history of monetary activity, I guess, throughout the history of the world, going back 2,000 years. This period, in the last 40 years, we have hit both historic peaks and lows in the interest rate. Now, why is this significant, Jim?
The reason it's significant, John, I had an epiphany. You know, they call investment classics classics for a reason. These are books whose wisdom they impart stand the test of time in every generation. And just like when you look at finance, Ben Graham's book, The Intelligent Investor, Security Analysis are classics in business. Another one was a book written called The History of Interest Rates by Sidney Homer and Professor Silla. And what they document, what really hit me when I was reading this book, is that we are living in one of the most unusual periods of history. No other human beings on the planet have lived through what we've experienced in the last 40 years financially when it comes to interest rates. Because in the book, The History of interest rates were at 20% in 3000 BC. And this was before the invention of money. Before money, there was credit. And if you wanted to borrow money, or actually you wanted to get some kind of financial asset, because there was just basically credit. Let's say you were a farmer and you needed money for seed or grain or personnel to help bring in the harvest. You could borrow money, and there were two forms of way you could borrow it. You could borrow it in grain, and the equivalent interest rate was 33.5%. That was mainly in the countryside. If you lived in the city, you were a merchant, you had a shop, you sold pottery, or you were a trader, and you were selling traded goods, you could borrow at an interest rate in silver of 20%. And so interest rates were at 20%. Then they fell. And throughout human history, they have averaged between 6 and 8% for almost 5,000 years. Now, there were periods under the Romans, periods during the Punic Wars, the Napoleonic Wars. And in wartime, governments spend money and they inflate. And so there were spikes or short-term spikes in short-term rates where they got as high as 12, 14, and 16%. But if you look throughout that extended period of time, interest rates average between 6 and 8%. Well, we got to that point, John, when I began my career back in 1980 and 81, when treasuries got up to almost 16%. I can remember getting 18% in a money market fund, and you were able to, on lower quality bonds and credits, able to get 18, sometimes 20% in junk bonds back then. There weren't as many. It would take almost a decade, Mike Milken and Drexel Burnham Lambert, to bring that market into play. But nonetheless, we hit an interest rate we hadn't seen in 5,000 years. Fast forward to where we are today, and we've seen the lowest rate of interest in history. And it's not just that we've seen the lowest interest rate. So we've gone from the highest rate of interest in 1981 in 5,000 years to the lowest rate of interest in the summer of 2016, when we got down to about 1.3% on 10-year treasury notes. And I think in the next downturn, you could see that come down to one. But almost $9 trillion of sovereign debt that exists today is at negative interest rates. And if you look at short-term rates in Germany, they're negative by almost 0.75%. If you look in Italy, a 2-year note is negative. If you look in Switzerland, you have to pay the government almost 1% to give the government money. They're negative in 10-year notes in Switzerland are negative. They're negative in Japan. So in this time frame of 40 years, we've seen something we have never seen before. The extreme end on the high end of interest rates at 20% in 81, and the extreme end on the low side of interest rates, where they are now negative in many parts of the world, mainly Europe and Japan. And so we've seen that in the time frame within, what, 3 or 4 decades. And I think that has enormous implications going forward in the next economic downturn, because what does the Fed do? And when the Fed got to the financial crisis in 2008 and 2009, they'd already brought interest rates down to zero on the short end. So the only thing that they could do is really make interest rates negative, meaning the rate of return on interest rates was below the inflation rate, which gave you a negative return. So the only thing they could do to drive interest rates further is on the long end, on 10-year maturities, 20 and 30-year maturities. And the way they did that was simply printing money or quantitative easing, buying in the marketplace bonds, driving the price down, and in the process driving interest rates down, which resurrected the housing boom that began in 2012 when housing began to recover. And then also it drove a tremendous increase in the financing of auto loans, which is a bubble in itself, because it was easy to finance a car. You could finance cars at 1, 2, 3% rates, lease rates, or even cheaper. So the consequence of these low interest rates bears a lot of import in terms of what the Fed may be able to do, or for that matter, the government, in the next downturn. Because when you've shot most of your bullets, what do you do? In this last downturn, all they could do was simply print money and try to drive down interest rates, which is giving rise to arbitrage. And that's something we'll talk about here in just a minute.
Let's move on to the next topic, and that is that of bubbles. We have had bubbles in tech stocks in 2000. Remember, after the euphoria of the 1990s, I remember people I was working with were all excited about it. They were looking at what the market was doing every single day. You know, it's the old sky is the limit type of thing. We had bubbles in real estate and commodities in 2007, 2008. Of course, that blew out, giving us this major financial crisis. But now, 9 years now, we're into an economic upturn, and we have new bubbles. And so where the bubbles are and where they're likely to burst and what it's likely to do is really the next subject we need to look at.
Yeah, we talked about this in May when I first raised the question where the next bubble is in the financial markets. And I said it was passive indexing. And if you take a look what has happened to passive indexing, we've gone from $11 million in index funds in 1975, where they were almost unheard of back then, to $4 trillion today. And if you take a look at the amount of money that is flowing into passive index funds, $506 billion in 2016, where you had a negative outflow in what we call active funds. And what first raised this question in my mind was back in March and April, I began to look at some of the FANG stocks, which were very popular. You know, Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and Google. And I began looking at these stocks, and I was saying, who in their right mind would be buying stocks at these multiples? And, you know, I've given the example before of Amazon, which has a market cap of almost $500 billion, has sales of $160 billion, and is selling at 252 times earnings. And if you take Amazon, you can take their nine biggest competitors, which includes Walmart, which actually has sales of $500 billion, Costco, which has sales of $127 billion. You can take Target, Macy's, Nordstrom, Best Buy, the nine top retailers, add them all together, and their market cap is less than Amazon. And then you have Netflix, which has a PE over 200. So I began looking at who in their right mind would be buying this. And as I began to research this, I began to look at who were the top 10 holders of these stocks. And we did a filter screen on the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ, the stocks with the highest PE ratios. And we began looking at who were the top 10 holders of this. Now, in the past, you might see a hedge fund, you might see somebody like Carl Icahn, Warren Buffett, or, you know, some mutual fund like Fidelity Magellan that was the largest holder of a particular stock. But what I found in every single instance of these stocks that were way overvalued was they were the largest 10 holders of these stocks were the index funds themselves. Now, we talked about the implications of this. And the implication is when money goes into an index fund, if you listening to this program have money in the S&P 500, let's say you're in the spiders, or you're in the Qs with the NASDAQ, or maybe you're in the diamonds with the Dow. Apple represents almost 3% of the weighting in the S&P 500. So even though there's 500 stocks, if a index fund gets $100 million of new money, they're going to put 3% of that in one stock called Apple. If a index fund like the Qs or a NASDAQ index fund gets new money, they're going to put 11.6% of that money into Apple. That's the weighting in the NASDAQ. Or if you're in the diamonds, Apple has a weighting of almost 5%. Likewise with Microsoft, has a weighting of 2.2% in the S&P, 8.4% in the NASDAQ, and 2.3% in the Dow. So when you look at the weighting of a lot of these stocks, Apple, Microsoft, Johnson & Johnson, Amazon, you go to the NASDAQ, it's Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, Facebook, Google, Alphabet, Comcast, Cisco. All that money is distorting these valuations because in an index fund, let's say I manage the index fund for one of the big mutual fund companies, whether it's Vanguard or it's BlackRock or it's Schwab. If I get money, I get $100 million, I have to buy those stocks according to the percentage weighting they represent in the index. I can't say, well, you know, I don't want to buy Amazon at 252 times earnings. That's crazy. You buy them. It is thoughtless investing. The money goes into the index fund and the index manager simply buys the stocks and their percentage weighting. And here's how it can distort things. Even though there's 500 stocks in the S&P 500, the top 10 stocks represent 16% of the index. Even though there's over 3,000 stocks in the NASDAQ, the top 10 stocks represent 51% of the index. And likewise with the Dow, there's 30 stocks, but the top 10 stocks of the Dow represent 55%. And so I had this discussion. I'm trying to think what technician I had on the show. If you want to beat the market, all you do is just buy the top 10 stocks in the index and you will beat the market because that's where the majority of money that goes into any index fund, whether it's the spiders, the Qs, or the diamonds, that's where it goes into. And John, that's what's driving these extreme valuations that you see in many of these stocks.
Yeah, but you know, if we look at this, you have all of these tendencies driving money into these stocks and pushing them up and up. What happens when all of this reverses and the money rushes out?
You have a decline in a waterfall decline in reverse. So just like I mentioned, if you are in a index fund, and let's just say everybody starts coming out of index funds, and what does that mean? Well, if money is coming out of the S&P, if it's the spiders, the Qs, and the diamonds, well, that manager is going to sell in the S&P fund, he's going to sell 3% of Apple. He's going to sell 11.6% in the NASDAQ. He's going to sell 4.7% in the Dow. Likewise with Microsoft, 2.2% in the S&P, 8.4% in the NASDAQ, and 2.3% in the Dow. So these stocks will decline the most because they represent the largest weight of the index. So you have a reverse decline. Just as you have these companies setting new records, you will have these companies on the reverse side setting new record lows. And we'll get into another issue that is going to face this next downturn. What do you do when there's only four or five guys that are the main holders of these stocks? Who do these guys sell to? And that is something that I think nobody is really thinking about today. So where the bubble is index investing and how this has changed the market. There was an article recently, I'm trying to think if it was in Barron's or the Wall Street Journal. And one of my technicians also commented on the program in the sense that one of the reasons that the VIX is so low is when you have a large percentage of trading every single day on the markets is occurring as a result of algorithmic trading. Computers don't have emotions. They don't have fear. They don't have greed. They just trade according to whatever the algorithms are. And so that has been taken out of the marketplace. Likewise, when the vast majority of money going into the market is going into index funds, you don't have anybody sitting there at a desk and analyzing and go, gosh, taking a look at the growth rate, the profitability, the margins. Do I really want to pay 250 or 200 times earnings for a company? So you have human thought being taken out and you have automatons like robots that are running the market. There isn't, you see a lot of absence of human thinking in what goes on a day-to-day basis. And it feeds on itself. The more the market goes up and hits new records as it did this week, the more money goes into passive index funds. The more money going into passive index funds, the more money will be going into these stocks that represent the largest cap weighting in every one of the indexes, or in the case of Dow, the largest price weighting. The higher the price of the stock in the Dow, the greater the weighting it will get, the more money will go into the stock. And likewise with the NASDAQ, or for that example, the S&P 500. So it feeds on itself, which is what you saw in the latter stages of a bubble, whether it was in housing, where more money kept going into housing because you can't lose money in housing. People were getting rich. Houses, which were on leverage because most people buy them with a mortgage, they were going up 10-15%. If you were leveraged with the mortgage, imagine the kind of wealth that you're making. Well, the same thing is taking place in the market today. It is feeding on itself. The higher the indexes go, the greater the market weight, the more money goes in these index funds, and it becomes a self-feeding bubble until it gets to extremes. And right now, this is the second highest valued market in history. The first one being the market in 2000. We have now exceeded the valuation highs that were reached in 1929, making this the second most expensive market. I don't think, John, will ever get to the crazy valuations that we saw overall in the year 2000, but I may be yet surprised, depending on how much this feeds on itself, because one of the reasons I think this business cycle has lasted as long as it has, and the same thing with the market, is the Fed has kept interest rates down for such a long period of time. Remember, it has taken them almost 4 years to raise interest rates only five times.
Next thing I'm calling dark risk, because until you actually check the stats on this, you aren't aware of what's going on here, how few institutions control the majority of our financial implements. So let's put it that way. So go ahead and point out why this is, first of all, what kind of a situation we're in, and then what kind of a risk.
Well, let's go back to the financial crisis in 2008 and 2009, where we saw all these bankruptcies, and especially it really developed rapidly when the government let Lehman go under, because it was a domino effect. And then next thing you saw AIG, Merrill Lynch, Wachovia, a lot of, you know, Bear Stearns earlier, Countrywide, and Washington Mutual, all these firms went under. And what the government did is they came in with the larger institutions and they merged them. So, for example, Lehman Brothers went to Barclays and Nomura. Washington Mutual went into J.P. Morgan Bank. Bear Stearns went into J.P. Morgan Bank. Merrill Lynch went into Bank of America. Countrywide went into Bank of America, while Covia went into Wells Fargo. So what happened is these institutions control the bulk of the nation's deposits are in just five members of the banking system. J.P. Morgan has almost $2.6 trillion in assets. Bank of America is number two with $2.25 trillion. Wells Fargo, number three with almost $2 trillion. Citigroup, number four at $1.8 trillion. And Goldman Sachs at almost $900 billion. So the vast majority of this nation's deposits are held in just a handful of financial institutions. So as a result of the financial crisis, the big got even bigger. So this nonsense that Dodd-Frank eliminated a lot of this risk, do you really think in the next financial downturn, if there's problems in the derivative market, the government is going to come in and let J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, or Citigroup go under? There's no way. Now, the government may end up taking over these institutions if there's trouble, much like they did with GM and much like they did with Fannie and Freddie. They may end up becoming almost the equivalent of public utilities. But you have the largest concentration in human history in our banking system is focused in just five companies.
You know, we hear about derivatives a lot. Now, aren't these companies that are holding the bulk of these other financial instruments also the same ones holding the derivatives? And of course, there's a tremendous potential here for a lot of income, but at the same time, a huge amount of risk.
Absolutely. If you take a look at it, now there's good news here. From its peak in 2013, derivatives have gone from $230 trillion to today, they're roughly about $179 trillion. But of that $179 trillion, the bulk of it, 93%, is held by just four institutions. J.P. Morgan, the biggest, owns $63.5 trillion. Citicorp, the second, at $45.5 trillion. Goldman Sachs at $32 trillion. And Bank of America at a little over $23 trillion. Now, the banks would argue, hey, that number isn't as big because it's netted out. And I'll get to the problem of netting out here in just a moment. But here's the implications of this. If you look at J.P. Morgan, they have total assets almost $2.7 trillion, and they have equity of $264 billion. That's the cushion, $264 billion against $63.5 trillion. So the equity is peanuts compared to the risk exposure. Now, they would argue that 85% of these derivatives are netted out, meaning that the best example I can give you, and just let's just keep this simple. I have $100 million invested in the stock market. I want to reduce my risk, so I go short 50%. So I reduce my exposure from 100% to 50%. But how do I do that? I do that by going short through another institution or buying puts through another institution. So my hedge is only as good is the financial viability of the firm I have hedged with. And so therefore, and we saw this with Lehman, when you saw this domino effect, because they're all interconnected. There's about a little under $600 trillion in derivatives worldwide that is held by just 10 financial institutions. So the problem is these guys all have cross relationships with each other. You know, Bank of America may be hedging with Goldman Sachs. They may be hedging with Citigroup or J.P. Morgan or Deutsche Bank or Union Bank of Switzerland or Nomura Bank in Japan. So they're all hedging with each other. The problem is, what happens if one of these firms gets into trouble like Lehman did in 2008? Then all of a sudden, or AIG, which wrote, what, $500 billion of credit default swaps on all these bonds, and they couldn't deliver. So the government had to come in with $200 billion. And of course, you remember TARP, it was $700 billion to recapitalize these financial institutions. So this idea about netting reduces risk is absolute nonsense, because the bulk of these assets are illiquid. They are marked on value on the bank's balance sheet based on economic models, because they don't trade on an exchange where you can actually see the value of the stock. Like if I own IBM, very easy for me to call up on my computer what the value of IBM is trading on, let's say, the New York Stock Exchange or its value within the S&P. These derivatives, the bulk of them, are not exchange-traded derivatives, so you have no idea what they're really worth. Their value or their worth is priced on economic models, and you don't know the real value of a derivative until it comes time to sell it. And if it's you have it valued at $100, but there's no buyers of that derivative until it's $50, that's when you really find out when the tide goes out, the emperor has no clothes. That's when you find out who really, what these derivatives are really valued at. And that's the real risk I think that we're facing here, John, is that a lot of these derivatives are illiquid. You don't know what their real value is. Over 90% of them are interest rate related. And what do we know about Fed rate raising cycles? They usually end up in a crisis in the economy, the financial markets, and financial institutions getting into trouble. And you've seen this throughout history of Fed rate raising cycles where you actually have a lot of financial institutions go under because what happens? Interest rates go up. People make bad bets. Financial entities can't pay everywhere from junk bond companies that are kept alive right now because of unusually low interest rates where they're able to roll over their loans. Well, that may not happen when you get into a cycle where rates are actually going up. And I mean, if you take a look at going back to the early 80s, every single crisis that we had began with the Fed rate raising cycle in a financial institution. You can go back to in the 1970s, the bankruptcy of Penn Central that occurred in a Fed rate raising cycle in a recession. Fast forward to the bear market and recession of 74, Franklin National bankruptcy. Go fast forward into 1982, Latin American debt in the Farm Belt crisis. 83, 84, Penn Square in Continental Illinois goes bankrupt with Drysdale Securities. Junk bonds in 1989 and 90. The Asian crisis, long-term capital management and Russian default in 97 and 98. And then the subprime crisis in 2007 and 2009. So that's why we spend a lot of time talking about the Fed rate raising cycle, because these guys will keep doing this until eventually they crash something. And that's where these institutions that are leveraged either with debt or derivatives, that's when the problems surface. And you don't really know who is the problem until the tide goes out. And that's why this idea that Brooksley Bourne at the end of the 90s was basically booted out of office by Robert Rubin and Lauren Summers and Alan Greenspan, because she was saying, hey, this is a real problem. This is going to create a financial problem later on. We need to put these derivatives, regulate them, and put them on exchanges. Of course, she was booted out of office. And of course, we know what unfolded in 2007 and 2009. The very thing she talked about actually happened.
Now we're getting to the question that everyone seems to be facing right now is tax reform. It was one of those things that President Trump ran upon. The tax, quote, reform, end quote, doesn't seem to be quite that, however, and may wind up being a Trojan horse. It's also coming at a time that if you are raising interest rates and lowering taxes, you're working opposite to each other. And what happens the next time we come into a big crash where we need some manipulating room? So let's look at, first of all, the tax reform itself, Jim.
Well, you know, if you take a look at the various things that they're proposing, number one is the reduction of the number of tax brackets, and they would lower. Right now, we have 7 brackets from 39.6 all the way down to 10. They would be simplified to 3 brackets, 12%, 25%, and 35%. And the 25% bracket would replace the 15%, the 25%, the 28%, and the 33%. The 12% bracket would replace the 10% bracket, and then the 35% bracket would just remain in place. They would eliminate the 39.6. But what they're also going to do And this is the Trojan horse. They're going to eliminate medical deductions. They're going to eliminate property and casualty deductions. They're going to eliminate miscellaneous deductions. They're going to eliminate deductions for state taxes. They're going to eliminate the deduction for property taxes. And if you are in a high tax state like I am in California, or you live in New York or some of the other states that have some of these higher tax brackets like Illinois, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, New York, several of these states, even Oregon and Hawaii have high tax rates, and many of those states also have accompanying high property taxes. John, this will, for many people, we ran some estimates, and a lot of people in the upper middle class income brackets are actually going to be facing increased taxes. So that's number one. So they get rid of the tax deductions. And as I've pointed out in a similar program, this happened in 86 where they got rid of the sales tax deduction, the excess write-offs from real estate, and also what we used to call limited partnerships where you could get these tax deductions. They got rid of all those in exchange for lower rates. We had the lower rates for 1 year. Then George Bush Sr. Raised tax rates to 31%, followed by Clinton, raising them to 39.6. And on top of that, without the repeal of Obamacare, you still have 3.8% Medicare tax on income and also investments of all sorts. I don't care if it's rent, annuity income, interest income, dividends, capital gains. You pay 3.8% if you're in a certain income bracket. What's to stop a president from another party? Because I'll tell you one thing, you get rid of the deductions. Let's say in 2020, the next president is a Democrat. What he does, he just simply raises the tax rates. And he can say, like Obama did, well, I'm just simply raising them back to where they were before, which is what Obama said when he raised the tax rates back up to 39.6. He actually raised more than that, but the media talks about just the 39.6% bracket, which was where it was under Bill Clinton. So that's what I think is the real Trojan horse here, because they get rid of these itemized deductions, John. And you think about, let's just think about what just happened in the latter part of the summer, the hurricanes that hit Texas real hard, Puerto Rico, the islands in Florida. Well, one of the things you can do is you can deduct 10% of your property and casualty losses if they exceed anything exceeding 10% of your adjusted gross income. Well, think of what those people that lost their homes in Texas and Florida, they're going to be able to deduct that on their tax return. Well, if they get rid of that, they won't be able to. Or think of somebody like an elder, let's say an elder parent that goes into a long-term care facility that can run anywhere from $6,000 to $8,000 a month here in California. You can deduct that as a medical expense. That would go out the window. So they would get rid of this. And for many individuals that live in high tax states like California, New York, and New Jersey, think of what happens when you lose your, probably for many of you, your largest itemized deduction. Now, what they would keep would be the deductions for charity and the deductions for housing, because they're too strong of a lobbying group and would affect too many homeowners in this country who are voters.
As I hear you, I'm guessing you're not in favor of this.
No, if there's any kind of tax reduction that I would be in favor of, John, it would be the reduction of tax rates for businesses, because you know what? Our tax rate is the highest in the world at 35%. Well, I hate to tell the government, the idiots that are sometimes running Congress, 35% of zero is still zero. And that's why you have, it's been estimated $2.5 trillion. I've heard the real number is $4 trillion of untaxed profits. And the way we work, and we're the only country that does this, let's say that I am Apple and I have $100 million of profits in Germany. And I'm just going to throw this out, some simple percentages. Let's say Germany has a tax rate of 25%. The average tax rate on corporations is 22%. So let's just use 22%. So Apple has $100 million of profits in Germany. Germany taxes Apple at a tax rate of 22%. So they take $22 million in profits. Apple has $78 million left over. We're the only country that says to Apple, if you bring that $78 million back to the U.S., we're going to then tax you for the second time at 35%. They would be absolutely crazy to bring that back, which is why you have so much money that is kept overseas. It's already been taxed by the host government in which the profit was earned. But then the U.S. taxes it again when it brings it back home, so it's doubly taxed, the same way the government double taxes corporate profits. The government taxes a corporation. If a corporation, let's say, makes $100 million in the U.S., they pay 35% or $35 million to the government in the form of corporate taxes. Now, let's say of the $65 million that's left over, the corporation takes half of it, $30 million, and sends it to you, the investor, in the form of a dividend. You, the investor, will then pay a tax of anywhere from 20% to 23.8% on your dividends, in addition to any state taxes you would pay on those dividends. So the U.S. taxes corporate profits twice, once when they're earned overseas, once again when they bring them back over here, and they tax corporate profits within the United States twice, when it's earned and when it's distributed again to the individual shareholders. So I would be in favor of that, because otherwise the profits are just going to remain overseas. It would be good stewardship, and any company would be considered crazy to pay a 22% tax overseas and then bring their profits back home and pay the U.S. government another 35%. So they are proposing a tax, a universal tax of only 10%, and going more towards a universal tax system. We would still be taxing it twice. We would tax it at, let's say, 22%, which is probably the universal tax rate overseas, and once again at 10%. But 10% is a heck of a lot better than 35. So I would be in favor, John, of a lower corporate tax rate, because, like I said, our tax rate's 35%, and 35% of zero profits is still zero. So the government isn't getting a lot of this profit, which remains sheltered overseas, because you don't want to bring it home. Why would you pay the U.S. government an additional 35% tax? That is the one part of the tax bill that I would be dramatically in favor of, getting rid of the double taxation that the U.S. employs.
Okay, so I'm assuming, let's go to the last thing here. What this would ultimately result in too would be an out-of-sync status between the Fed's monetary policy and the tax policy that Congress is trying to put through right now.
Yeah, this is, like I said, this goes back to one of the first themes that we developed, that the Trump presidency is unlike any that preceded it. It's beginning at the end of a business cycle and halfway through a Fed rate raising cycle. So if the tax reform or the tax bill went through, you'd be putting through stimulus, which you normally don't do towards the end of a business cycle. Typically, governments have used stimulus, either fiscal or monetary stimulus, when the economy is in a recession. So to bring you out of a recession, the government kicks in spending, as Obama did with almost $1 trillion in 2009, and the Fed kicks in stimulus with lower interest rates or quantitative easing, as the Fed did in 2009 with the $1.2 trillion in QE1. So in 2009, we were in a recession. We needed stimulus. And the government did it with spending on the fiscal side, and the Fed did it with monetary stimulus on the monetary side. So the two were working in conjunction. Fast forward to where we are today. We're at the end of a business cycle. And now, if they put through this fiscal stimulus with tax cuts, it is going to create more overheating in the economy, which is likely to raise the inflation rate, which will likely make the Fed more aggressive in its rate hikes. And we know where that all ends. In other words, if the government comes in now with fiscal stimulus, it is going to be counteracted by aggressive monetary policy that withdraws stimulus in the form of higher interest rates and shrinking its balance sheet. So the two policies are now opposing each other. So that's one point. The second point is the Fed has fired all of its bullets in the last financial crisis when they brought the Fed funds rate down to zero. It's one reason why they've raised it five times. We're only at 1.25. You got to remember, Greenspan, who brought rates down to 1% in 2001, began raising rates in 2004 when the Fed funds rate was only at 1%. So he was able to do it in quarter point increments over a period of time until the end of 2006, when the economy was beginning to slow down, housing had peaked, And we saw interest rates really start to impact the economy, because by the end of 2007, we were in a recession and a bear market. So the Fed has used up all of its bullets. It's trying to reload the chamber, which is the argument given for renormalization of monetary policy. But with the other problem that we have, and it's another issue that makes the Trump presidency different from those that preceded it, Trump inherited $20 trillion in debt. Obama inherited $10 trillion in debt, and he took it to 20. Bush inherited $5 trillion in debt and took it to 10. So the previous two presidents each doubled the national debt. And that amount of debt, nobody thinks about the implications of this, but it carries an interest rate. And if interest rates rise, it means the government's going to be paying more in interest, something it hasn't done in the previous 8 years. Even though Obama added $10 trillion to the national debt, the interest expense for the Treasury actually went down throughout the entire Obama presidency as the Fed brought down interest rates. So I don't think the Fed is going to be able to get interest rates back to anywhere where they think they're going to go, which is 2.75%. The only way they would do that is if this fiscal stimulus coming in from tax rates heated up the economy so much that the Fed could then put full pedal to the metal on the gas pedal and begin aggressively raising interest rates almost like at every single meeting. So the thing that we have here, John, that is I do not like, and I think this is going to create friction. If I was Trump and Yellen comes up for a reappointment in January, it's not clear if she'll be reappointed or even wants to be reappointed. I think if she was smart, she would exit the scene like Greenspan did before the manure hit the fan. Remember, Greenspan retired and people are thinking, my God, the maestro's retiring. Why? Well, Greenspan knew we were headed for trouble. He got out of Dodge. And so if I was Trump, I would appoint somebody less aggressive and less likely to sabotage the impact of the tax cuts. And that's why I think this is not going to bode well for the way this goes, because you've got monetary and fiscal policy at friction with each other. But at the same time, if you expend, in other words, if the government expends all of its energy with the fiscal tax stimulus during a business recovery, when the economy is doing well and the unemployment rate's the lowest it's been, what is it going to do when we get in a recession? Are they going to cut taxes further? Is fiscal stimulus going to come in even a larger? In other words, are we going to go back to not only $1 trillion deficits, which we're eventually heading towards, or are we going to be going to $2 trillion deficits, which would literally bring down the dollar? So these are things, John, that are out of sync. The Trump presidency is out of sync with those that preceded it. We are seeing the most unusual interest rate period in human history. We are seeing the buildup of what I call a bubble in passive indexing. We're seeing the concentration of risk. We are seeing fiscal stimulus coming at a time that's opposing monetary stimulus. And we're seeing, if this takes place, we are seeing the government putting itself in a position where if we do head into a recession, they would have to resort to extremes in fiscal policy. If you've already lowered tax rates, if you've already increased this fiscal stimulus, what are you going to do when we get into a recession? If you're the Fed and you're no longer at a Fed funds rate of 5% the way we were in 2004 when Greenspan began cutting interest rates, what if we only get to 2.25%? What if we only get to 2.5%, or the Fed's own view, it gets to 2.75%? I don't think we'll get there unless we get this fiscal stimulus, which would inject a huge amount of money into an economy, which would create a faster nominal economic growth, but it would also create higher rates of inflation, which would encourage the Fed to get even more aggressive in its rate hikes. So these are 5 or 6 themes, John, that we see that are all going to play out. And quite honestly, we've never experienced this before. So that's why it's one of the reasons why we've been doing this research and trying to figure out, okay, during the next downturn, where do we want to be positioned to preserve our clients' capital? In 1999, we got out of stocks. We went into foreign sovereign bonds, eventually into gold. In 2008, about the only thing that worked was gold bullion, but primarily cash in treasuries. What will work in this next downturn with these unusual circumstances. And this is the thing that keeps us up at night in what we're researching.
Well, Jim, this is going to be a big weekend for you as we close out the program. You have your investment strategy conference in San Diego. And I think these trends are ones that are going to carry us now through the end of the year and into next year, but they're the questions that have to be raised. I'm always amazed when you look at what the media cover versus what's actually going on that's critical, how there's a disparity. But I think you were thinking about starting a new article series.
Yeah, I wrote a series at the end of, let me see, I started The Perfect Financial Storm in 2000. Finished it at the end of 2000. And then I began another series about the housing market in 2004. And John, I'm going to take these five or six themes and start a new series because I think they're important because nobody's really talking about them and the implications. And I hope to have my first general article articulating the six themes we just covered here and then get into detail in each theme going forward as I begin a new series. I'm actually going to be returning to writing because I think it's important that this information get out there.
So next week we'll be back pursuing what?
Well, we're in the middle of corporate earnings season. We're also going to be looking at the economic numbers. The interesting thing that, to me, is going to be how strong the economic growth is in the third quarter. Now, we were tracking over 3%. They think that we'll still hit 3%, but there was a question whether the hurricanes might have impacted the economic numbers for Q3. We're going to be looking at corporate earnings, what companies are saying about the future. We're going to be looking at the probability, highly probable at this point, of another rate hike, the third this year, coming in December. We'll be looking at retail sales going into this December season. And then, of course, we're going to be looking at, do we get tax cuts by the end of the year or certainly at the beginning of the year? Those are going to be the big questions we'll be monitoring here in the program. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend. And of course, if you are attending our conference on Saturday, well, I'll be seeing you there and hope to meet you.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.